All right, everybody, let's have an AA meeting. My name is Kat, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story.
Hey, everybody, I'm Alan, and I'm an alcoholic. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view, the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear idea of what happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, we'll hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I have one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight's speaker is my friend Zach.
Hey, everybody, I'm Zach, and I'm an alcoholic. Friday will be 19 months. That means my sobriety date is January 11th, 2016. I got out of jail that morning from my second DUI in 5 years, and on the jail cell bed that night, I was on my knees. I had a jail cell to myself. It was the grace of God, because I might have been too proud to do it if there was another guy in the jail cell with me. But I was on my knees in that bed praying for some essence, something down inside of me to wake up and guide me out of how I was living my life. So I'm going to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I'm not going to be in my drunkalogue too long tonight, I hope. I saw a billboard on the way down. I'm from Gainesville, Georgia. I currently live in Oakwood. But I saw a billboard on the way down here for like an orthopedic doctor's office that said, "Stay focus on the solution." So I hope I'll be getting sober before too long. And I won't be telling you all these war stories, because I know we all have our war stories. And, you know, my story is enough as it is. I'm saying that to, like, clear it for me, because I'm going to want to tell it in a certain light to let y'all know that I'm alcoholic enough, that I was wild enough, and I want y'all to like me enough. And my story is enough as it is. I don't have to add to it or try to shine a light on it and do those kinds of things I always did that were so characteristic of my alcoholism. I always was trying to be who I thought y'all wanted me to be, and I never did know who I was. So I'll get right to it. When I was born, don't have a whole lot of memories. Early childhood, my mom and dad were divorced, and they hated each other. You know, when I was real young, every time they'd get around, like, hand us off, you know, from dad's weekend or mom's or whatever, they're about getting a fight. You know, there's a lot of tension. And there were times where I got pretty scared because, you know, mom's like, "Dad's going to hurt us, you know, lock the doors and stuff." And so anyways, and I'd be around other kids and their families, and they had whole families. Like, the mom and dad lived together, and they seemed to love each other. My mom and dad hated each other, and that broke my heart. Kind of getting a little older in preschool, I was with some other guys, and we were comparing belly buttons. They had innies, I had an outie. And they teased me. And that sounds like silly and childish, but being rejected because I was different, you know, and being made fun of, just being, that hurt so bad at that age. Like, I made up my mind, like, I don't ever want to get dejected or rejected again. Like, I want to fit in so bad and be accepted by others. And at a really young age, I started giving, you know, other people power over me. I had no idea, you know, I was just a kid. Getting older, I was one of the shorter kids in the class, but by God, I was going to be the fastest. You know, I had that inadequacy, that chip on my shoulder. I had that real young. That started developing too. As I say, you know, just I had to come up with something to add up, because naturally, what I bring to the table is not enough. It's inadequate. And like I say, that was a pattern that began back when I was a kid, and I didn't, you know, like, and that, you know, is something, that's one of those things, and, you know, alcohol is a symptom of that. And so getting older, I didn't get in a whole lot of trouble. I was a pretty good kid. Stole beers, you know, back in, like, what, fifth grade, going to sixth grade that summer. Drank a couple beers for the first time with my cousin, and you know, had a little buzz and did that again a couple times. Got a little buzz. First time I really got drunk, I was 15 and spent a night over at a friend's house. And we had, you know, smuggled some liquor bottles in, or liquor and Gatorade bottles into their house. And we were going to, you know, get drunk. And so this is my first time real drunk. Some people talk about like the feeling of guilt melting out of their shoulders, or, you know, they just instantly fit in. This is what I kind of remember. What I remember about my alcoholism, and it was telltale of my alcoholism until, the last time I drank. When I started drinking, I was just automatic. You know, like, I was just going to drink more. It didn't make me feel a certain way or something. I was just, like, stuck to that bottle. Or the bottle was, it stuck in my hand. And I was drinking it till I couldn't drink any more of it. You know, and like I said, I was just an automatic. And that's the way I always drank. I'm a blackout, pass out drunk. And I will drink as much as I can until I black out and pass out. And that happened, you know, over 1,000 times over the years, you know, 1,500, who knows, 365 days in a year. But anyways, so that was the first time that I got drunk. You know, went through high school, and now I was like the good kid who couldn't, you know, who got in a lot of trouble. So I got forgiven for a lot of stuff. But, you know, I actually came to AA when I was 18. My grandmother was struggling with pills, and I went into AA in Gainesville with her because, you know, if I kept getting so damn drunk, mister, you know, you're going to go to AA and you're going to see what it's like to be an alcoholic. And so that was going to straighten me out. If I had to be around y'all and see what kind of, you know, low life y'all were, then that would make me not want to be an alcoholic enough, and I wouldn't drink that way anymore. It didn't work. I went to college, and I just started getting, you know, partying all the time. Substances are a part of my story. I'm not going to be in that too much because I think when we're going to stick with singleness and purpose tonight. But I'm also a drug addict. But alcohol was like a common denominator. Every time I ever did anything, you know, alcohol had to be a part of it. It was a release from boredom, which was something, you know, that was, there's different things people drank for. For me, it was that release from boredom. You know, it was creativity, you know, a little bit of mischievousness. You know, it was excitement, you know. And as I say, that was because my experience of life was just naturally, or just inadequate. Everything I experienced in life just was not enough. And that just permeated what I did. And that's how, like I said, and that's how I felt about myself too. But, say I partied in college. I developed a reputation as like a skeez and a scumbag. I was a manipulator, and I would, you know, try to get others to partake in the substances I wanted them to partake in. And everybody kind of like got to know my game. The people who like to, you know, party a lot and use a lot, they're like, we don't want you around, Zach. We know what you're up to, man. You know, like, get away, you know, because I owed money to people, and I owed money to people that I didn't want to owe money to. I was afraid, you know, they might come, you know, hurt me or something to collect the money. And like I say, I was just kind of like a scumbag. I had no respect. I didn't realize what a joke I was, you know. I mean, I was so filled with ego, and I thought I was really hot stuff. But, you know, I would get hammered, and I was the butt of the jokes. You know, I was the laughing stock. But in my own, you know, I denied that. In my own head, you know, I was the man, you know. And I was just really delusional through those years, you know, very egocentric. And y'all know what that's like, you know, the egomaniac with the inferiority complex. I was just totally delusional about, you know, how others viewed me. And it wasn't so important how others viewed me, but just, you know, I didn't have any respect. You know, nobody respected me. Like I say, I was a joke, and I was a drunk, and just had that reputation. I got charges for alcoholism. You know, I was at Georgia Tech game one year, back the sophomore year of college, I think, and, you know, this is how I would act once I got drunk. You know, my dad put it in a good way. I got arrested for minor possession of alcohol. You know, when I get that stuff in my system, the rules no longer matter. You know, I just don't listen to rules. You can't tell me anything. And I was holding some sign or something, you know, I was showing my ass. And out of 100,000 drunk people leaving the Georgia Tech game, I was the one of like the two or three that went to the drunk tank. And my dad put it that way, but that was kind of, you know, like, you know, I don't think he was trying to show me I was an alcoholic. But when I look back at that, you know, it's like, yeah, that's me. That's my alcoholism. That's that self-destructive behavior. But that's one of many times I got arrested. I've been arrested a whole lot of times. All drinking related. Every time I didn't get arrested every time I drank, but every time I did get arrested, I was drunk. And every time I drank, I was drunk. I never drank and got a buzz. I always drank and got drunk, got hammered. In the book, when I was reading through the big book, as my sponsor told me to do, it really jumped off the page. I think it was page 27 with the Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and it talks about he is more or less always insanely drunk. And I was like, oh my God, that's me, you know. Talk about, you know, being seldom mildly intoxicated. And like I say, there's so many places I identify with in that book, and I'm trying to move on through this so I can get to recovery. Went on, you know, drinking and using. It got scarier. It got uglier. You know, I got pulled out of school for the charge I got in Georgia, and I failed the drug test with my probation officer, and you know, things went downhill. So I came home, and you know, I was in one of those like weekend reporting things where you get tested and stuff, and you know, I figured out the game, like which part of the month they would test me, and so. You know, as soon as I took my test, then I'd be back off to the races and show up to my classes. But I never was a functional drunk, by all means. After I got my first DUI, I was looking at losing my license. And I lost, you know, I've lost more jobs than I can count on two hands related to alcoholism. I used to not count some of them because, like, one job I quit. The reason I quit that job is because I was going to get effed up that night. And I didn't want to go into work. You know, so I wasn't drunk when I quit, so it wasn't alcohol that made me lose the job. You know, that's bullshit, you know. So when I count it like that, yeah, I've lost more jobs than I can count on both my hands. But, you know, I lost about three or four jobs in a row, all alcohol related. And so it's tough on a resume getting hired, you know. I mean, it's tough, you know, trying to hand somebody a resume and get a job, and they're like, well, can we get some references? And it's like, no. Like, really, you know, you seem like a pretty good candidate. Is there anybody we can talk to? It's like, no. You know, and so anyways, you know, it was difficult, as I say, and I was looking at my first DUI, and the DUI came around. I thought I was in total delusion about the DUI, by the way. You know, I was hammered. I was completely hammered, but at that time, I was like, that cop's an asshole. He's got it out for me. You know, this was with my lawyer. I was like, we're going to beat this thing, because I wasn't drunk. And like, I took that delusion into my legal case. I was going to beat this DUI in the court system in Clark County, which was not happening. And I finally, you know, decided at the very last minute, it's like, well, you better take the plea deal. So, I took that plea deal, about to go on probation in the state of Georgia, losing my license. I can't get hired because I lost this many jobs in a row. So, I ran away to Colorado, a geographical cure. And, of course, you know, running to Colorado, it didn't get any better. It just got way worse. And I didn't realize what I was risking when I ran away. You know, being able to be with family. I'm from here, from Gainesville, so all my family's here. And when I ran away, it didn't enter my head at all. Like, if they call you in and you're doing all the stuff you're doing, like, I can't pass a drug test. I'm, you know, over 1,000 miles away. I'm on probation in Georgia. If they call you in, I was on non-reporting, so I thought it was genius how I like slipped probation. It went into the ego. I got away with a lot of stuff, and that went right to my ego. You know, I stole some guy's car in Gainesville one night and was able to get away with that, and, you know, I had to make a tone with the guy, and he decided not to call the cops because I'm so charming, and I talked him out of it. But, like I said, all that stuff just went to ego. I thought I could get away with my shit, and come to find out I couldn't. But, so went out to Colorado, running away from my disease. I brought me with me, and it got worse in Colorado. Like I say, all sorts of substances in addition to alcohol, but alcohol, you know, became more and more of a regular thing. I found a job where I could drink on the clock, and all my other friends, it was a restaurant, and everybody else wanted to drink and party like I did. And we were all sick together. We were all pretty sick together in that restaurant, in the way that we used alcohol, among other things. It just got worse and worse there. And so another geographical cure. I moved from Breckenridge, Colorado, to Denver, and I was going to get a better job and, you know, start getting some traction with a career, because that was going to, you know, make things better. And it just got worse in Denver. And I would have nights where I'd be like, you know, like, you've got to take some time off. You've got to stop doing this. And right there again the next night, I'd be, you know, back at it again. And then that, you know, that cycle continued. You know, I'd say, man, you know, take a couple nights off, man. Give your body a break. And, you know, somebody'd say, hey, you want to do something tonight? And, you know, offer me a drink or offer me something else. And I could not say no. I knew I didn't want to say yes, but I could not say no. I was supposed to, you know, not be drinking and using whatever. And I didn't have the power to say no. My brother's also in this program. And we both joke. Like, we have a yes problem. We say yes to everything. You know, do you want to do this? Yeah. Do you want to, you know, do you want another one? Yes. You know, do you want to, I bet you won't do that. Yeah, I will. Anyways, and that was part of my personality. I really, you know, I used to think I was real wild, and you know, getting into trouble and getting out of trouble and all that stuff. You know, that was part of my identity of who I thought y'all would like. You know, I wanted to be a rebel and a renegade, and that's egoism, right? The rules apply to everybody else, but they don't apply to me because I'm, you know, I'm a renegade. I'm wild. That was just manifestation of egocentricity. You know, like I say, thinking that I was above the rules or was smart enough to beat the game or get around the rules. And that's just something that I feel is telltale of alcoholics, my alcoholism. It wasn't working in Denver. Like I say, I would keep using and drinking, and I told myself I didn't want to or I wasn't going to. And, you know, one night came along on March 10th of 2015, and it got real. Like I say, I mean, I don't need to qualify myself. I mean, I am an alcoholic, y'all. Like, I wouldn't be here at AA speaking if I wasn't. But, you know, I can wake up in the morning, you know, coming to who knows how many hundreds of times. And, you know, like, waking up in, like, the front seat of a vehicle, you know, and the car's running, and, you know, it's morning time, you're out in some yard, and it's like, what in the fuck, you know? And so I've done all that stuff. I'm an alcoholic. I don't want to spend too much time trying to prove to y'all that I had self-destructive behavior. I totally was not thinking about any of the people I loved, as I say, when I ran away to Colorado. Like, I had just an experience one night that got my attention. And I asked God for help, you know. Now, this was before the jail experience. Like I say, I got sober in 2016. So, you know, I asked God for help. And, you know, I had to deal with the consequences I put myself through the night and the substances I had put in my body that night. I had to kind of ride that out. But, you know, God showed up, and I asked for help in a minute. You know, I wanted God to back off. It was one of those foxhole prayers. I was asking Him to back off those spirits that I'd, you know, kind of brought upon me with the cocktail of very powerful substances I was under. And like I say, you know, He did, and I was just real burned by alcohol and other substances. And I called my brother. He's been in the program for a couple of years now, and say, hey man, you know, I feel like I might need to go to AA. I've been up all night long. If I want to go, can I show up at a meeting? Like, I'm probably still a little bit, you know, got, you know, substances in my system. And he's like, man, if you feel like you need to go, you ought to go. So I showed up to my very first meeting at St. Michael's Episcopal Church in Denver, Colorado. It's a great meeting. You can hear the church choir practicing upstairs. It's like, well, I remember about my first meeting, I felt safe. I showed up, and there were these people in there, and they were sweet people. You know, like, I felt I was in a room with good people, and it was a safe place to be. And I was happy to be there. And, like, already in my first meeting, I'm having these, like, rosy fantasies of when I've got, like, a year and a half or 2 years, and everybody knows me, and I'm part of the group. I didn't want to think about day number two, you know. Like, I was thinking about when I'm sober and it's all well and I'm happy. But I got in there and I went to another clubhouse in Denver. And my second meeting, I shared all my frustration. I was about 3 or 4 days sober. And I was, you know, I was pissed. I was angry. I'm an angry alcoholic at times. I'm not always angry. You know, that's an emotion that I feel sometimes. But I've done a lot of anger in my life, and anyways, and I was honest. I didn't, you know, sitting there and say, oh, it's going so good, you know, day number four. I was like, man, this sucks. I don't know what to do with myself. And some guy, you know, some guy with some time, he saw me and he said, you know, he came up to me after the meeting and we talked for a while. He became my first sponsor. He had great sobriety. You know, he had 27 years at that time. And he got me doing some work, had me write down my definition of prayer, my definition of meditation, my definition of God. And we read that and we started working together. And it was going well. I was getting sober. And I hit this thing called a four-step, and that was just like a brick wall. You know, like now I've got to look at where I've been in my short, or I've got to do a fearless moral inventory of myself and how I might have been ugly to other people, or what was my part in all the shit I've been carrying around. Like, I that was something I was not prepared to do. So I went back out, and I happened to be moving back home to Georgia, which was about 2 years ago, and to get a great job. You know, I did that thing where you tell your people that you love that I'm getting sober now before you should ever do that. You know, like, it's kind of like a nice step amends. You know, I didn't make an amends, but I called Mom and like, hey Mom, you know, I've been clean for 2 months and I'm getting better, Ma. And I shouldn't have done that. Hindsight, so it was 2020. I didn't know a whole lot about the program and when you're supposed to do amends. But so I, you know, I came home, you know, going to be, you know, returning home, and I'm getting my life right, and I had to pass a drug test for my new job that, you know, stepdad had got me because I'm living right now, and I had to come home and be like, guys, listen, I can't take that drug test. And they were like, oh man, we thought you were better. And it's like, no, not yet. And so anyway, I just had to drop a bomb on my people moving home, and that's what I always did. You know, I always just drop bombs on the people I loved with the arrest, like having to call from jail. You know, I mean, I heard the people that loved me, and I had no idea. I was just so in myself. I had no idea how much I was hurting the people that loved me, and like I said, I had no clue. Had no clue at all. So came home. And started going to AA again. My first time I went back, my first relapse, I was out for 5 days and two drunks. You know, each time I got way more wasted than I intend to. I was going to drink like a moderate drinker because I learned some in AA, like how people who aren't alcoholics drink and how people who are alcoholics drink. And I was going to go back out and not drink like an alcoholic so I could drink again. You know, I wanted to be able to drink again. It didn't work. And I brought myself back in after two drunks and 5 days. This was hopeless. And, you know, I'd moved back to Georgia. And the first time I was sober, I put together 3 months. The second time I put together 5 months. And the Halloween party was going on with old friends in Decatur. And I was in recovery in Alpharetta and Roswell. And my recovery friend's like, what are you doing for Halloween? I was like, I'm going to go to this party. And like, well, we're having a recovery party. And what about that party you're going to? I'm like, yeah, it's my old buddies and stuff. And like, should you go to that? And I was like, yeah, it'll be fine. And so I went back out, you know, that was, and I had 5 months that time. So I figured this thing was progressive, you know. I went, got 3 months, then I got 5 months. Next time I'm going to get like 7 or 9, you know, I'm getting better at this thing. So, but the second time I went back out, I had a firm resolve not to come back to AA. Y'all were fucking with my head, y'all were trying to brainwash me, and y'all were telling me all this stuff that was really messing with me in here hardcore. I couldn't trust my instincts anymore. You know, I was, like I say, I was just majorly screwed with, like, upstairs. Like, my MO, how I operated as a person had really kind of gotten, I don't know what, you know, like I say, y'all were really screwing in my head, and I was not coming back. So I came back less than a month later, and, you know, I'd scared myself. It was, you know, once again, it was scary, you know. I mean, I would nearly kill myself. I mean, I remember just being really shit-faced, driving from Gainesville down to Roswell. And, everybody told me I'm not allowed to drive. You know, I'm the same old alcoholic, you know, telling me I can't drive. I ran, like, grabbed my keys and ran out of the house. And that was just an example. That's the kind of stuff that always went on. You know, you can't tell me anything once I begin to drink. So I was back in AA, and this time I'm back for good. You know, I've learned, and I'm going to be better now. December 2nd, it's going to be my new sobriety birthday. I did work with a sponsor that second time. That 5 months, worked with a sponsor. He was a great sponsor. We read through the big book together, and he showed me how Bill took the 12 steps and during Bill's story. And it was great. You know, he was he led me back to the 4-step, and bam, once again, brick wall. You know, like, not doing that. And I had to fill out these boxes and columns, and that goes back like the renegade thing. Like, I don't do boxes and filling. I hate doing my taxes, you know, because I'm a squiggle. You know, I'm not like a straight line filling the boxes guy. That's not my style. And anyways, that's a bunch of bullshit. So, like I say, he gave me the columns to do, and I was like, stupid, this sucks, you know. Conveniently, I was moving, so it's like, hey, man, you can't be my sponsor anymore. I'm moving, you know. You know, Gainesville's going to be too far away now. I'm moving to Roswell, and conveniently, you know, I ditched him. I got another sponsor, but I did a really super watered-down version of the four-step. He let me call a four-step, and I would drink again. So, anyways, went back out, firm resolve not to come back, and I've come back December 2nd, and this time, I'm back now, and I'm home. You know, welcome home, yay, I'm home now. I'm not going to do it again, guys. I was going to meetings, some of the same meetings and stuff. New Year's Eve hit, and that's a holiday I had not come up on. I made it through St. Pat's. I didn't stay sober, but, you know, I didn't drink on St. Pat's. I didn't drink during March Madness and those things that I needed to drink for, like I always used to do. I sure didn't make it past Halloween. But New Year's Eve, you know, like the symbolism for our different holidays, you know, like the symbol of New Year's Eve is like the wine glass, the champagne glass, you know. And I was lonely. I was very lonely. And I was telling him, of all nights, you know, of all the nights in the year, if you're lonely, how are you going to sit at home and feel sorry for yourself instead of getting out there and mixing it up? You know, I'm an alcoholic. I can talk myself into a drink very easily. So that was my excuse that night. And I went out and I went to this concert for the same old rock band I've been to 100 times, Widespread Panic. I had my heels dug in against the drink. I was not taking a drink, and I was ready for that. And my friend offered me a substance that, you know, and I was like, yeah. And as soon as I said yes to that, race is on. I'm doing everything else. And this is New Year's. Hey, I had fun on New Year's. We got a cab. I'm responsible. Like, I'm cured. Had a blast. We took a cab. I didn't get a DUI, and, you know, no arrests, nothing scary happened. I woke up or came to like I did, but it seemed, you know, reasonable. I was at a friend's house. And so, next weekend was coming up, and I was cured, and it was playoff football. And so I think the Saturday evening I went to my local Hooters, which was I like to drink there by myself and conduct the drinking experiment. Because I'd heard about the drinking experiment in the book, you know, if I could just drink two and walk away. So I walked in to do this experiment, and I was going to get two, the idea was to get two regular size ones. And I was like, let me get a beer. And she's like, you want the 16 ounce or the 24 ounce? I was like, let me get a 24 ounce. And I was, you know, and so I was like, all right, you can still have two, but since, you know, the 24, so that's kind of cool. You know, you get to have two big ones. I couldn't have just two big ones, you know. Like, I had to have four big ones and a shot before I could, like, scrape myself away from the bar with a spatula. Like, you know, you're not supposed to be drinking like that, you know. And had a good little buzz on, drove home. I was going to do it again on Sunday, January 10th, and I started at the Hooters, and I drank all day. I started at the Hooters, and then I went to this other bar in Roswell, which was a Green Bay Packers bar. I don't give a shit about the Green Bay Packers. But I was at this Green Bay Packers bar. I was the only guy in that whole bar with a blue shirt on. Everybody had yellow and green on, but I was drunk and high-fiving with people. I was, you know, lonely, right? I'm not lonely anymore. I'm drinking with people. I'm released from the boredom. You know, same old thing alcohol did for me. You know, that magic that I gave alcohol. But normal drinkers don't give alcohol magic. I gave it magic. I'm not a normal drinker. I was at that bar, and, you know, that just wasn't doing it. And I decided, you know, I mean, NFL playoff football is pretty cool. Man, it's 8:40. I wasn't supposed to go this long. So I was like, you know, NFL football is cool and everything, but I really like the strip club. So I'm going to go out and have some real fun. And it's Sunday, and I got to be at work on Monday morning. And this is a Sunday. And so I go on my way, and I'm hammered. And I rear end somebody, and we pull over, and, like, I talk to the guy, and I'm like, hey, it's okay, you know, not bad. Here's my number, call me in the morning. So, cool, he didn't call the cops, and I'm not going to jail. On to the strip club I go, And I rear-ended somebody else. And so this person called the cops. And they asked me, they said, if you're drunk, you don't have to call the cops. I thought they were trying to trick me or something. So I said, no, you call them. I'm fine, you know. And so they showed up, you know, and actually I was reported I left the scene because when he told me the cops were coming, I was like, okay, good. Let me just go to Walgreens right here. And like I would come out of Walgreens, all these blue lights. I got a pack of gum. And I was too drunk to put the gum in my mouth or anything. You know, I went and bought the pack of gum, and I come out and call the police, and I'm hammered, you know. Same old thing. You know, I'm not getting off. But so anyways, that brought me to jail in Atlanta. Second DUI in 5 years. That old alcoholic in me would have said, well, the first DUI was 4 years and 10 months ago. It's just bad luck that you landed 2 and 5, man. You know, like, that's just your bad luck, buddy. And just the man's screwed up. The system's all messed up, and... you know, that's just a man socking it to you. And, you know, that's just the stuff I kind of, the lies I said to myself. You know, I got to jail that night, and I prayed that prayer for this, whatever was inside of me, what I would, my idea of a higher power to wake up and guide me out of this, because I don't want to do this anymore. And since that day, I haven't taken a drink. You know, I remember getting out of jail that morning. I was kind of open to what people were telling me. The jailer, you know, when he lined us all up to, you know, either get bonded out or whatever, he said, you know, I'm going to treat y'all like people, but the thing is, I learned from my mistakes. You have a chance to learn from your mistakes. And I was like, yeah, you know, I'm damn right. You know, I'm ready. You know, I'm not going to do this anymore. And so I got my ass back in AA. I picked up, you know, another white chip at 8111 down in Roswell. And I made it to the group that I'd gone to before, which is the Roswell Friends group. It's a great group. There was older people in there with a lot of time, which was good for me because I'm one of those alcoholics who likes to, like, pipe up all the time when I'm brand new in recovery. Like, I got this shit because I'm one of those... I'm the person who always wants to impress other people and stuff, even though I'm full of it, you know. I was trying to tell people how sobriety works when I have like a month and a half of sobriety, you know, rather than sitting down and shutting up. I keep talking, trying to act like I've got it, which is the very kind of thing that keeps me from getting it or being able to receive any of it. By the grace of God, I was with this group full of old-timers with awesome sobriety where I was just convinced to shut up, man. You know, like, shut up. You don't know anything. Listen to these people. They know it. They understand it. I used to resent the part in the big book where it said you cannot transmit something you do not get, because I didn't have it, but I wanted to talk it. I didn't want to walk it. I wanted to talk it. Characteristic of my being, how I operated for years and years. So went to that group, got my current sponsor. His name's Jack King. He lives over there in Roswell. He still goes to that group. You know, every time he shared, it was just real practical. You know, it wasn't fancy, advanced AA gymnastics. It was just, you know, practical sobriety. And I just appreciate what he had. And he happened to be chairing a meeting, and he remembered my name. And that was like the two things. Like, when I showed back up, he remembered my name. He had me chairing a meeting that night, and he had to, like, read through the spiel. And it says, if you need a sponsor, see me after the meeting. I was like, perfect, you know. And I saw him after the meeting, and I was like, hey, I need you to be my sponsor. He's like, whoa, easy, you know. And he's like, we'll talk about it. And so he would end up being my sponsor. He is my sponsor. And I've gone through the steps with him, and I finally did a real step four. You know, I was the same thing. I hit that wall of step four, and, you know, I dug my heels in once again, like, just couldn't do it. This sucks. I hate this. You know, just threw a total tantrum instead of doing step four. He gave me a prompt sheet, you know, which had some great stuff on doing step four. It said, you know, the pain of step four is not in doing it. It's the resisting doing it. You know, when you're actually doing it, it's not so bad. But I drug it out forever. And I finally did it 6 months later. It took me 6 months to do a four step. And I happened to be in a relationship which was not advised. You know, like, I'd been going in and out of AA, and I knew when you were new in AA, you weren't supposed to be in a relationship, so I hadn't been. But, you know, now it's been a couple, you know, it's been a little while, and I hadn't gotten laid, and my cousin set me up with this girl that's cute, and, you know, so that relationship stuff's out the window. And so I got in a relationship, and my sponsor advised me not to. He's like, I don't think you should do this, you're 2 months sober. need to be focusing on, you know, your recovery right now. But, you know, what did he know? So anyways, you know, I got going with this girl, and, you know, in hindsight, it became what I needed to see how I operated, because I was in it was very selfish, like all my relationships had been with females, with everybody. But, you know, romantically, I was using that person for companionship, for sex, for pride. You know, I don't have to show up alone. I've got a date, you know. And like I say, I totally did not care about what I was giving to that person, and I was, you know, not acknowledging, like, that person's emotions, or how, you know, I ended up hurting that person very much, because I had to break up with her. It was like, hey, listen, I've been going through emotions, and so I was really sick, you know. I didn't realize how sick I was. I had to look at that. That was when I just picked up my yellow chip, and I had my 6 months chip. 2 days later, I had to break up with this girl. And, like, having a chip for 6 months doesn't feel like shit when you feel like, you know, it's like, dude, that is so ugly. Like, you are such an ugly person for how you just treated that person. And so anyways, you know, the chips are just, you know, the symbol. It's not quality, it's quantity. And what else? What am I trying to talk about in recovery right now? So, you know, that was back when I picked up 6 months. Lost my train of thought, damn it. You know, thank God for these rooms. Life is so different for me. You know, I was just such an egocentric person, like we all were. You know, I mean, when I say, like, I have a big ego, like all y'all did too. You know, I thought mine was exceptionally big. I mean, I used to think I was such an exception. I used to think I was so unique. I'm not. You know, I'm a garden variety drunk. I'm a dime a dozen. I'm run of the mill. All that stuff. I'm very average drunk. You can read about me in the big book. I mean, like, all those stories are my story. Like I said, I was really special when I got here. And I was just about too special to get this thing. But thankfully, you know, my substance problem was strong enough that, you know, I had to keep coming back. And I think I kind of get what people say when they talk about being a grateful alcoholic. Because if I didn't have a substance abuse problem, my character defects probably wouldn't have been, like, bad enough or painful enough to make me change. It was the lash of alcohol that, you know, the pain being the great motivator that made me want to do something different, made me want to live differently. You know, if it had just been my pride and my ego or my jealousy or low self-esteem, those kind of things, you know, I'd probably live with that shit a long time before it got painful enough, you know. So now, you know, via, you know, being whooped by alcohol, now I have a chance to look at this stuff and see, you know, if it's worth keeping in my life. But I did that 4-step. I filled out all those boxes, and I got to the last column where it's my part in it. And I was like, this is so stupid. That's the point of the second column, where it's like the cause. You know, you got the person, the cause. And obviously, the cause means it's their fault. It's not my part in it. But I dug my heels in once again, and I finally just did it. And at the top of the list was my old man, was my dad. And you know, I started writing on that 4-step what my part in it was with my dad. And you know, at first it was tough, but by the end of that paragraph, you know, it was almost a page long, like the pen was just writing and flowing, and I was forgiving my old man for all the shit I had carried my whole life against him. And I was like, holy shit, this is what it's supposed to do. Like, this is why you do it. And so then I could do the rest of it. And so I went through the rest of the 4-step, acknowledging my part and all the shit I'd done to other people. You know, other family members, other loved ones. I sat down from a sponsor and I told him that. And once again, like, you know, the part about my dad, I guess I got dad issues because my dad left when I was real young. But when I forgave my dad again from another person, I was just, I cried my eyes out. And I was just so emotionally drained, I could, like, do the rest of the 5th step and I didn't have anything left. You know, like, I just, like, you know, lost it all in the very beginning, out of the gate, talking about dad and, like, say, letting him off the hook. And I admitted all the other things that I'd done to my sponsor. And, you know, he had so many things that he had done like me. You know, I talked to him about ex-girlfriends. He's like, was that a sex, drugs, and rock and roll girlfriend? I'm like, yes, sir, it was. He's like, yeah, I know. That's typical, man. And I told him my fears, you know. And he gave me, like, this great sage advice. He said, Zach, all your fears are all, like, they're all way out here. Every one of your fears seem to be occurring in the future. He's like, I tell you what we're going to do. This is for your personal program of recovery. We're going to take it all, you know, right here and now. And it was just like, it was genius. Like, how come I didn't think of that? You know, and because you know, because my thinking sucks. That's why. Today it's not really like a battle so much if I'm going to pick up a drink or not. It's, am I going to be in self-will or not? Am I going to get up in the morning and go wrecking around this world trying to impose myself on everything I come across? You know, like drinking's going to be second to that. That's going to come way before drinking will. It's like me trying to, as I say, impose myself or dominate life everywhere I run into it, every step of the day. And that's, you know, where prayer is meant so much to me now. I used to not have a relationship with a higher power. I was raised in a Baptist church, and there were people who were real Christian, and they were like, they were lame and not fun. I was wild, and they were real stiff, and I just didn't care for any of that. And you know, they seemed to always be coming down on me when I was drunk or I was high or whatever. You know, they were always just, you know, on my case, and so I didn't care for them. And this God that they were into, it just wasn't for me. I didn't think it was for me, really. But I read that stack of self-help books that was, you know, this high trying to get better. You know, I never did anything when I read those self-help books. I just read the books. It was easy, right? I could sit on my ass and read books instead of, you know, doing anything or looking at myself, and they made me feel good. So I was trying to help myself in some way, but there was just no action with it. And it's not like this program where self-examination is a part of it. And it's I've got a sponsor taking me through it. And I have to say, I tried to get better because of how deep that resentment was with an ex-girlfriend. You know, she broke my heart. She treated me like I treated so many other people. You know, I mean, she just walked on me and didn't give any care. And when I really think about it, I mean, like, I wasn't that great of a boyfriend, you know. I mean, I certainly wasn't the guy that the girl I would want to be with would deserve. And I really wasn't that into her either. I was really into the idea of her being into me because I had really low self-esteem. I didn't realize what low self-esteem I had. You know, all my life I had masqueraded as a guy who, like, felt good about himself. I was a cool dude. You know, I was real popular. I was cool, all that bullshit. And, it was a big front. All my life, it was just a big front. I didn't want anybody to know how little I felt about myself. Because the truth was, you know, I thought I was damaged goods from the get-go, you know. I mean, like I say, my mom and dad hated each other. I felt broken. And as a little, you know, as a kid. The big secret I was keeping was that I didn't feel good about myself. I didn't think I was very cool. And if y'all knew that, y'all would know I wasn't worth being around. Y'all would know I was worthless. And if y'all knew my secret, then y'all wouldn't hang out with me for sure. You know, y'all wouldn't have any, like I say, just a deep terror of being rejected or not accepted. And as I say, you know, I didn't realize what low self-esteem was. I had so much pride, too. I didn't realize they're kind of like the same sword, you know, it's just different edges to the same sword. And, you know, I had a sponsor once again illuminated for me. It's not about if you feel good about yourself or feel bad about yourself. I'm always thinking about myself, you know. I don't know how much time I have left. I got a couple minutes. I hope I've been doing worthwhile. I don't know if I have. I don't have a choice in drinking. You know, I've lost the power of choice is what the first step means to me. Without this program in place or some sort of spiritual program in place, I will drink and use again. I will get back in that self-will, and stuff's not going to go my way, as I found out. And when stuff doesn't go my way, the only way I've got to cope with it is using. You know, what I've got now is I've got a higher power of my understanding, and I can handle stuff not going my way. Because it's not up to me. You know, that's like the biggest saving grace in this thing, is it's not up to me anymore. You know, like I say, I can let things go that don't go my way, and that's beautiful. I didn't really care for God, but I started praying. And like these people in my family did, you know, started praying to a God of my understanding, which was not the same as the Christian God or any other religious tradition. It was a very personal God. And things started happening, you know, following that DUI, I started praying, and like that very prayer, you know, things started happening in my life. That, you know, I've heard somebody say, is it odd or is it God? You know, it certainly was odd. It was really odd. It might have been God. I really think it was. I believe in a higher power, some kind of, you know, essence that exists in like a fourth dimension simultaneously, like an energy kind of moving through all of us. And I believe it's down, like deep down in all of us. And that's why, you know, when people share this, things that are good, you know, sometimes we hear like, if you spot it, you got it. I've heard from a speaker that, you know, he feels the same way about good things like service and recovery and helping other people. You know, the reason that resonates is because it's already in there. You know, if it wasn't in there already, it wouldn't resonate at all. And I just appreciated that. And I've also heard about not yet's in recovery. You know, I haven't taken a sponsee through the 12 steps yet. You know, some of the sponsees that I had, you know, I'll give them an assignment, like, read the doctor's opinion, which doesn't seem like it's that hard. And I ask him, you know, did you read the doctor's opinion? And he starts talking about car trouble. You know, it's like it's a yes or no answer. And he starts talking about car trouble, but that's neither here nor there. I get to stay sober if I try to help other people. I'm a member at Serenity House of Buford. I just started going there a little over half a year ago when I picked up my blue chip. I moved to Oakwood, and that's a great clubhouse. There's a lot of good sobriety there, and I chair meetings there, and I'm involved in recovery. I was still exceptional even when I got sober. I didn't want to get a home group, you know, like that's for normal alcoholics. I bounce around, like I'm really looking for, like, you know, a girl, which is why women go to women's meetings. They don't bump into a dude like me in a meeting who's trying to pull some kind of 13th step shit. It's funny because it's true, right? So, I mean, I can kid, I can be self-effacing these days. I used to take myself really seriously. Like I say, I was Mr. Cool, and I was just in total denial. My image of me and who I really was did not fit. So it was painful returning to equilibrium. You know, in my head I was this big, in real life I was about this big. So kind of, you know, making it back to equilibrium, that was some painful ego depletion, but yeah, it's the best thing that's happened to me. You know, I mean, I live in the real world now. I'm still prone to fantasy. I can get in my car, listen to music, and I go off into fantasy. I try not to as often. It's progress, not perfection, because all those fantasies are grandiose. You know, I'm having some fantasy about how, you know, I'm doing some kind of thing great, like play a guitar and on a stage, and I don't even know how to play guitar, you know, and everybody's loving me and that kind of shit. I do that stuff. Like, I get in my own head, and that's the, what's that got to do with not taking a drink? Like I say, I live in reality today, and the reality is I'm not that powerful of a person. And there's a whole lot of stuff I don't have power over, and that's, you know, that's kind of the beautiful thing. My sponsor told me back to the fourth step, all those institutions I had resentments of, it's time. You know, I can't control those things. You know, what the hell is the point of resenting something you've got no control over, or you can't even touch with like a 100-foot pole? What's the point of being upset at it? And so I've learned stuff like that, and that's how I not take a drink, because if I'm on edge and I'm irritable and I'm discontent, you know, alcohol and substances, they look like a really good solution. So I have to stick in the spiritual solution that y'all have taught me. I've learned everything I know about sobriety from y'all, and I'm a beginner, and I'm forever a beginner and a student at this thing. And I love recovery, you know. And the people said stick around enough for the miracle to happen. The miracle for me is that I enjoy this way of life. I enjoy this life more than the old life. And back when I came in from the old life, I thought there was no way. This was a prison sentence. How could I ever have fun again? And life is funner. It's fuller. Everything about it is more is just a better experience. So I'll wrap it up. Thanks, all.
Thank you very much. Thank you one and all for joining the Blue Chip Speakers meeting tonight.
Well, my head was in tomorrow, and my feet followed history. I had an illness. notion I could hoodoo everything around me. No. 'Cause too much of everything ain't enough for nothing to me. I got a nudge from the judge, thought it put me in recovery. Put the plug in the jug, man, I feel like I've been set free. For too much of everything, ain't enough for nothing to me. Change and change.